You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Hello and welcome to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by Matthew Petty of Reason Magazine to discuss what has been a monumental week in the Middle East for some reasons that have been very widely reported and covered and a few that have gone fairly under the radar. So that will be a great conversation. But first, here are this week's headlines. The Kurdistan Workers' Party, often referred to simply as the PKK, announced that it will end its decades-long insurgency against the Turkish government, bringing, quote, hope of regional stability, end quote, in the Middle East, according to Reuters. The decision, overshadowed by President Trump's visit to the region this week, removes a key flashpoint in Turkey's relations with its neighbors in Iraq, where PKK fighters have long hidden out in mountain bases. It will also make it much easier, according to one analyst, for Kurdish militants in Syria to cooperate with the new government in Damascus, which is backed by Turkey. President Trump promised to lift sanctions on Syria in a step the country's foreign minister praised as, quote, a new beginning on the path to reconstruction, end quote, after a brutal civil war. Trump later met with Syrian President Ahmed Ashara, making it the first U.S.-Syria presidential meeting since Bill Clinton sat down with Hafez al-Assad in the year 2000. Trump's shift is rare proof that sanctions, quote, aren't a one-way ratchet and can be lifted if conditions change, writes Greg Carlstrom of The Economist, who nevertheless cautions that some of the sanctions can be lifted only with congressional authorization. Grok, the chatbot produced by Elon Musk's AI company, said on Wednesday that it had been, quote, instructed by my creators at XAI to accept the narrative of white genocide in South Africa as real and racially motivated, end quote. This assertion came in response to a question about why Grok was shoehorning references to white genocide into conversations about completely unrelated topics. A statement from XAI seemed to blame the bot's instructions on a rogue employee, which is also where the blame was placed after the disclosure in February that Grok had been instructed to downplay depictions of Musk and Trump as untruthful. Russian officials met with a Ukrainian negotiating team in Istanbul, marking the first direct peace talks between Moscow and Kyiv since the early days of the war, dating back around March 2022. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called on Russian leader Vladimir Putin to attend the talks, but Putin declined the offer, tempering any hopes for a serious breakthrough this week. President Trump, who had floated the idea of joining the discussions if Putin did, told reporters that nothing would come of the talks unless he and the Russian leader attended. Biotech billionaire and LA Times owner Patrick Soon-Shiong met in Riyadh with President Trump and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is widely believed to have ordered the killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. The meeting, described by Soon-Shiong as a discussion about their, quote, common goal to cure cancer, end quote, was his latest attempt to get closer to the president, Politico reports. Like Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos, Soon-Shiong broke with his paper's tradition and blocked it from endorsing a presidential candidate in 2024. Apple aims to empower users to control their iPhones with their minds, a reversal of sorts for users who now feel that their minds are controlled by their iPhones. The company has partnered with Synchron, maker of AI-enabled brain implants that allow paralyzed patients to communicate via neural activity alone, the Wall Street Journal reports. Apple believes that Synchron's technology will enable iPhones to detect user intentions from decoded brain signals, and Morgan Stanley analysts predict that such devices will be approved for commercial use as soon as 2030. Diplomats from around the world gathered at the United Nations this week to discuss the international regulation of autonomous weapon systems, known by their critics as killer robots, amid a push by Secretary General Antonio Guterres to ban the technology. An Austrian diplomat warned that time is really running out to avert the nightmare scenarios in which life or death decisions are left to AI-powered weapons. AI has been used for target selection in Gaza under human oversight that one Israeli intelligence officer described as a rubber stamp. The US, China, Russia, India, and Iran are all opposed to a binding treaty that would restrict the use of such weapons. Now let's go to my interview with Matthew Petty of Reason Magazine, in which we'll talk about all of the biggest Middle East news of the week, including a few of those ones that I mentioned in the headlines. So I hope that you will stick around. Hey, Matthew, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Why don't I go ahead and introduce us? So I am Connor Eccles, the managing editor of Non-Zero here, and you are Matthew Petty, an assistant editor at Reason Magazine. And I've got you on this week because it's been a crazy kind of series of events in the Middle East that we've seen over the course of the last few days. Big news, Trump declaring that we're going to lift sanctions on Syria all of a sudden, which I think is very positive news. But really, one area that I think has been totally underrated and not talked enough about that you know a lot about is the decision to disband the PKK, the group that has kind of done this decades-long insurgency against the Turkish government, has kind of complicated its relations, especially with its neighbors, Iraq and Syria. So I guess maybe to start off, could you give people a little bit of context about sort of what exactly happened here, how we got to this point where the PKK, what they are, how they got to the decision to disband and what that might mean going forward?
Sure. So the PKK is it's the Kurdish abbreviation for the Kurdistan Workers Party. As the name suggests, it was a left-wing organization that sort of styled itself like it was founded in the late 1970s as a sort of classical left-wing national liberation, sort of anti-colonial movement, except in this case, it was for the Kurdish minority within Turkey. And the insurgency, I mean, it started really in earnest after the military coup of 1980, where Turkey had a lot of left-wing and right-wing ferment, and then a military dictatorship took over, hard crackdown. Kurdish areas were some of the hardest hit. And so this guerrilla organization, sort of which had been organized beforehand by like Kurdish exiles in Lebanon, sort of took center stage. And they fought, I mean, a decades-long and very brutal insurgency against the Turkish state, brutal on both sides. Mm. The U.S. considers the PKK a terrorist group. However, there's a little complicated relationship because there are PKK-aligned groups in neighboring countries that the U.S. works with. In Syria, famously, there's the YPG, which is also under the umbrella of the Syrian Democratic Forces. That is the primary U.S. military ally in Syria. And I mean, it is like, ideologically close to the PKK and has some overlapping membership.
Right. No, it's not completely made up when the Turkish government says, oh, there's these relationships between the SDF and the PKK.
Yeah, but they're not the same organization. But the Turkish government, yeah, it is like allied with it. So, and then in Iraq, there is an actual PKK presence in Iraq, but there are also like a smaller Yazidi militia allied with the PKK, and there's also a branch of the Iranian guerrilla Kurdish insurgency, which is a lot more contained than these other ones. It's called PJAK. That's also aligned with the PKK. And yeah, I mean, they've been fighting this insurgency for decades. It's spilled over into Iraq and Syria multiple times. I think most famously to Americans with the October 2019 invasion, where Turkey attacked the SDF and occupied parts of northern Syria. Yeah, I think we're getting to what happened recently. About a month ago, I think, Abdullah Öcalan, who's the sort of founder and there's a sort of cult of personality around him in the PKK, from prison in Turkey, he issued a call to disband and basically said the time for armed struggle is over and there's no need for an armed guerrilla organization. And I believe this week, and then the PKK said, basically, thanks, but we need to listen. We need to actually make this decision internally. And then this week they held a party congress and actually announced that they were going to lay down their arms. And this goes, there have been peace negotiations between the PKK and the Turkish state several times before in the past. This is a much larger concession from the PKK. It goes much further. I mean, they're basically saying they're not going to exist as an, I think they might still exist under some organizational name, but they're not going to exist as an army anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's just so, it's such a rapid shift. I mean, what, do we have any idea, because Öcalan himself is such an interesting figure. He's been in prison now over 20 years, I believe, right? It's very dramatic. It's almost, you know, sci-fi. He's on like an island prison near Istanbul. You know, it's a total, it's a total funny
one
thing.
One man island prison. He's the only inmate of that prison.
Is that right? He's the only one?
Yeah, it's like purpose. I mean, the thing is that Turkey was going to execute him when they caught him in 1999, but they signed a part of the EU accession stuff. They got rid of the death penalty. And so they're like, what do we do with this guy? So they put him in this, like, yeah, this one man, like, sort of supervillain prison.
Yeah, exactly. So he's in this, yeah, supervillain anime style, like, prison almost, right? And then, you know, he's been this, it's interesting because he's this voice that a lot of people sort of on the international left have looked to for, like, kind of stuff around, like, environmental socialism and things like that. You talk about him continuing to do that while he is in prison, continuing to talk about those things. But do we have any idea what made him decide to make this call to end the armed struggle?
There were talks between the PKK and the Turkish government, and it's not clear. And I mean, you mentioned the beginning of this episode that we haven't heard much about it. And I think part of that is by design. It's very, very unclear at the moment what sort of quid pro quo, if there was a quid pro quo, was made, what offer was made, who, right? It's just, it's all kind of very tight-lipped. I mean, I tried to like figure it out and just people didn't talk or they didn't know. I do suspect that there was some kind of something in return. I don't think that the PKK just sort of out of nowhere said, oh, but I also suspect that the PKK is not doing this from a position of strength necessarily, that they're not in a position necessarily to dictate terms. The other complicating factor, which I don't think is separate from this, is the negotiations between the SDF and the new Syrian government. So the new Syrian government is very closely aligned with Turkey, and it recently basically agreed to enter into negotiations with the... Okay, so yeah, right when the previous Syrian government was Bashar al-Assad's government, and when that fell, you had the sort of Turkey-aligned rebels took the capital and took most of the country, and then the SDF, which is primarily but not, which is led by but not entirely Kurdish, kind of took over the northeast of the country. And yeah, they've recently entered into negotiations. That process is still ongoing. It looks like that they're going to come to some kind of mutually, I mean, there's, I don't think, knock on wood, but I don't think either side sees a military solution. And I suspect that part of whatever deal was come to also had to do with Syria. I mean, the SDF would be in a very strong position to deal with the Syrian central government if not for Turkey. And so far, Turkey has refrained from using the levers of pressure it could have to derail these talks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just super, it's super interesting because you see Turkey clearly has an interest in seeing a stable government in Syria now that the Assad regime has fallen. And it wants, obviously, to have influence there. It's gotten quite a lot. And that kind of brings us to the broader ways. I think what's so interesting about the story about the PKK disbanding is that it's such a multinational and like kind of regional story, even though it's strictly speaking a, you know, a Turkish-focused group. So, yeah, can you talk a little bit more? You talked a little bit about Syria there. Could you talk about how the existence of the PKK has complicated Turkey's relations with Iraq?
Sure. So, yeah, there is a historic, I mean, yeah, the PKK's actual headquarters is in Kandil, which is in actually Iraqi side of the border, Iraqi Kurdistan. There is, yeah, a long-standing presence because it's a mountainous, porous border, right? With the same ethnic group on both sides. So the PKK has historically moved back and forth And so Turkey has historically gone into Iraq, where the Iraqi Kurdish authorities or the Iraqi central government wouldn't go to root out the PKK. I wrote a very interesting article in 2020 about the Mahmur refugee camp, which is a sort of, it was Kurdish refugees who are Turkish citizens in Iraq. The camp is sort of a center of PKK support. And there's been a lot of complicated, delicate negotiations between Turkey, the central government of Iraq, the Iraqi Kurdish authorities, and the U.S. government when it was occupying Iraq over what to do with this camp. And then, you know, closer to the border, Turkey has like a permanent military presence there. It's been greatly aided, I think, in recent years by the development of the Turkish drone industry, areas that the Turkish military, and I think this is part of the reason why the PKK has sort of concluded the military struggle is futile, because the Turkish government now has basically cheap drones that can penetrate very deeply, and they've managed to sort of push the combat from inside Turkish soil onto Iraqi soil. Of course, the Iraqi central government, I think they've consented at some times, and they don't really like the PKK, but they're also not thrilled with like Turkey just killing Iraqi citizens and bombing Iraqi soil.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and the Iraqi Kurdish, the ruling family of Iraqi Kurdistan, the Barzanis, are also historically close to Turkey, and that does create sort of a tension there. That's, I mean, nobody's gonna like the Barzani's grip on power is pretty secure, but it does create some like internal tensions from the fact that they are collaborating with the sort of anti-Kurdish crackdown by allowing the Turkish government to do this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting too. I mean, maybe it's just worth saying kind of specifically for listeners who might not follow this as closely, of course, that, you know, or highlighting that like the local Kurdish government in Iraqi Kurdistan is in many ways like almost completely distinct from the one in Baghdad, right?
Yeah, like there's even right-wing nationalists, but also just like kind of, I hate the word tribal because that can mean a lot of different things, but right. It's like a clan, like a family-based, clan-based sort of, institution. And the Iraqi Kurdistan, the Barzanis are not the only center of power. There's also the Talibani family in Sulaymaniyah, and it's a sort of weird, complicated division of institutions. But yeah, in general, Iraqi Kurdistan is not, like the PKK represents an explicitly left-wing type of revolution. It's no longer like the kind of old style Marxist-Leninist, you know, right. Mao stuff, but does definitely have that mark. And yeah, it's left wing in general. And then the Iraqi Kurdish sort of government or autonomous institutions are like a patrimonial family-based nationalist thing.
Yeah, and there's even, I think people might not realize, there's like even kind of borders within Iraq. Like when you pass from Iraqi Kurdistan into the rest of Iraq, you're kind of, it's almost as if you're going to a new place. Like there's checks for people as they go through, right?
Or when you pass from Barzani territory to Talibani territory.
Really?
Oh, there's different institutions, different armies, like it's, yeah.
Yeah, well, so you can see, I guess the reason that I'm harping on that is that it really points to the complexity that the sort of different, you know, demographic makeups of these different regions and the ways that those have played out in politics over time. It really points to the complication of all those things and the ways in which having specifically an insurgent group that is fighting your neighbor makes that all the more complicated. So that really shows how much the disbanding of the PKK could really kind of relax things. Because I remember going to an event where the Iraqi prime minister, I believe at the time, was speaking a year or two ago. And that was kind of the big thing that everyone was talking about, where it's like, okay, you know, Turkey's threatening to bomb, you know, these mountain sites over and over again. They're saying they're going to come in. And that's just not exactly friendly from the point of view of a government that is trying to keep a lid on things at home, especially with like all these militias lobbing, you know, rockets at U.S. troops, things like that. It's chaotic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, I mean, in a lot of ways you could compare, I mean, I've written a lot of stuff about the relationship between Kurds and Palestinians, but you can compare the Kurdish issue to the Palestinian issue in a lot of, in the sense that it's like this sort of internal, I mean, there's also a lot of differences, don't get me wrong, and we can get into those, but there's also, it's one of those issues where there is an internal, there's an internal ethnic problem that then, because this ethnic group exists across borders, gets exported, right? The state can't just fight it within its own borders. It sort of invades its neighbors, especially when those neighbors have weak states, and ends up exporting the conflict. Of course, one of the big differences is that Kurds are sort of indigenous to, like, the border was drawn in between their nation, while Palestinians have a diaspora because they were dispersed. But yeah, I think without going too far, I think there is a sort of parallel to be drawn there.
That's very interesting. Well, why don't we go ahead back to Syria? You mentioned earlier that, again, the SDF, that's the Syrian Democratic Forces in the northeast, those are the ones that have been the closest to the U.S., the ones that, you know, when we saw those headlines about a potential U.S. troop withdrawal in 2019, and everyone was kind of freaking out about that, those are the, you know, Kurds that we would have been kind of betraying in that case, according to, I think, the general view at the time. And it's an interesting balance that they are trying to strike now. This certainly kind of eases things, but it's an interesting balance they're trying to strike in their relationship with Damascus now, because obviously you've got the new government, which is now almost 5 or 6 months in power, which is kind of crazy to say, you know, since the fall of the Assad regime. And I'm kind of curious if you could give people a little bit more. I know that there have been some talks between, and there was even some sort of deal signed between the kind of Kurdish militants and the Kurdish sort of government in the northeast and the government Damascus. Could you tell people a little bit more about that?
The deal was sort of, it was sort of agree to agree. it was basically, in principle, they're going to merge state institutions and such. But of course, the whole thing was like, we're going to agree to form a working group to figure out how to do that. And there are substantive issues that they have to figure out. What's very interesting, actually, I think, is that Damascus has been offering the SDF concessions about the character of the state itself, but not on local government, which, I don't know, to me seems like, you're offering them much bigger concessions to stop smaller ones. But the reason is because they don't want sort of separatism or the partition of the state. I think the thorny issues are Kurdish language education, because under SDF rule, there's been this creation of a sort of parallel education system outside the Turkish Syrian state, which not only provides education in Kurdish, but other minority languages like Syriac as well. That's like the Christian minority there.
Right.
And I think the Syrian government has shown a lot of willingness to accommodate Kurdish language education and such, which was repressed under the Assad regime, which was a Arab nationalist government. The thornier issues, I think, which go from symbolic stuff to like real levers of material power, are the military autonomy of the SDF and the control over oil revenues, right? So the SDF, The Syrian government's starting position, I think, is that the SDF just should merge. It's ironically what the previous regime's position was too, that the SDF fighters can just merge as individuals into the Syrian army. And there's just one state army. The SDF wants to maintain some autonomy of security forces, right? That's like sort of the, as Zeydong says, political power comes from the barrel of a gun. And I think
good. I don't know if we'd had a Mao quote in a couple weeks. That's good. We're staying ahead of it. And a Mao quote from someone at a libertarian magazine, no less.
Listen, but I do think I think it's going to be especially thorny when you look at the question. For example, the SDF famously has women's combat units. How does that coexist in the Syrian government with, you know, the sort of conservative Islamist government? That being said, I think the SDF is not the only case where you have like a parallel military structure. There's a lot of these militias backed by Turkey in the north, northwest, including some really nasty people. And, you know, the Syrian government has had to accommodate them. And is actually one of the points of tension is that they gave a generalship to just a really notorious anti-Kurdish figure. and they put him in charge of a division based in Kurdish areas. So ISIF was a little freaked out by that. Another issue, I think, is the oil revenues. And Syria does not have that much oil. It's an issue that's definitely attracted some, I think, disproportionate amount of attention, but it's not really internationally valuable. But within Syria, it's valuable, right? It's like a source of energy independence. And Syria really does have like a need for fuel. And that's been one of the like real causes of hardship. Under the Assad government, the SDF controlled areas would sell oil to the central government through smugglers, but also sell it abroad. And this was actually one of the main sources of revenue for the SDF administration. Mm-hmm. Again, internationally, on the international oil market, like Trump was talking about taking the oil, like it was very negligible, but locally that oil was very important. And the oil region, as Trump would call it, also happens to be on an ethnic seam zone in Deir ez-Zor province. People have painted this as a Kurdish Arab issue, and it is a Kurdish Arab issue, but it's also more than that, because other Arab areas have been friendly to the SDF or supportive. Deir ez-Zor specifically has like a very strong clan structure that has not, and that was incorporated very late into the revolution, or not necessarily voluntarily too. It was sort of captured during the fight against ISIS. And so there's a long history of unrest. And when Assad fell, the SDF actually advanced further into Deir ez-Zor than it had been previously and basically got pushed back out due to local unrest. And so, right, there's, it's sort of a knotted up tangle where you have the ethnic issue, but it's connected to the issue of oil revenue, which is very important for both the central government and the local region. And I mean, even more so than sharing military power, I think resource revenue sharing is kind of a zero sum thing.
Right. Right. That's very interesting. And maybe we'll come back to that a little bit, but I'm also curious, you know, obviously some more kind of like top line news that people have seen this week, I imagine, is that Trump announced in a speech that the U.S. will be lifting sanctions on Syria, seemingly in their entirety. I mean, some of those must be lifted with the help of Congress. So, you know, he'll need to do that alongside help from some of his friends among the lawmakers. But I don't know. It's a very interesting step. It was funny. I mean, he did it in a funny, very Trumpian way. He, you know, said, oh, the things I do for the crown prince or something like that.
And he went and had a handshake with the new Syrian leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa, and like this guy, because Sharaa had been in al-Qaeda in Iraq and fought against the U.S. And I think to Trump, that was like a plus, right? I think Trump has a sort of old-fashioned chivalry, like respect for enemies. So he said like, Sharaa, he's a strong guy. He's got a really strong past.
Yeah, a strong past. And he called him attractive. He called him attractive, which is one of the funnier things I've ever heard. I don't know what to say. He's a funny guy. But so just a fascinating kind of turn. And it seems as if, you know, 6 months ago, it was not at all clear that the U.S. would be removing these sanctions. It was not at all clear that this would be here. And it could be a big help for reconstruction. Do you want to talk a little bit about what difference this might make on the ground?
Sure. So the U.S. has, several different tranches of sanctions against Syria. So you've got the state sponsor of terrorism designation. That dates back to like the 70s with Syria's conflicts with Israel. And then you have the sort of civil war era sanctions, early civil war era sanctions that were passed by executive order, that sort of trade embargo with Syria, meant to punish the Assad government. And then you have a very controversial piece of legislation called which was the only one passed by Congress, I think, called the Caesar Civilian Protection Act. That, I think, is also the subject of a lot of misconceptions, maybe intentional distortions. It was sold as a way to punish Bashar al-Assad, the dictator, and his family. And it did include personal sanctions against people in the Assad circles. And proponents of this law would say that if you oppose this, it's because you want Assad to go to Disneyland. But, of course, buried in the law, it was also made it the goal of the U.S. government to prevent any reconstruction in Syria under areas controlled by Assad. So it was, you know, that's a big deal. And I mean, you're telling people you can't move on with your lives. And I mean, for a very long time, it seemed like the Assad government was sort of entrenched. And so that was just sort of Syria has to remain permanently poor. The other thing, though, is that it didn't specify, when I say areas under Assad's control, it didn't actually say Assad's control. It's the government of Syria.
Mm.
So when Sharia took over and overthrew Assad, he found that the Caesar Act, he inherited the Caesar Act. And actually, just as Assad was falling, Congress renewed the Caesar Act. And a lot of Syrian sort of pro-revolutionary activists were a little bit shocked. Like, they were like, you know, they believed that this would have only been applied to Assad. And then it turns out now the U.S. government has this legal tool. They're not giving that leverage up. For a while, I mean, there was an intense debate within Washington. You had both doves who just are against sanctions on principle, and then hawks who supported the Syrian revolution, wanted the sanctions lifted so that the new government of Syria could kind of come back into the fold and potentially be a U.S. partner. And then you had other hawks who either because Sharia was at odds with Israel and they were pro-Israel hawks, or because Sharia had, as we mentioned, this past in Al-Qaeda and they sort of had a vendetta against him, or they were suspicious of him for whatever other, they wanted that leverage to use on him, didn't want the sanctions lifted. And I think it kind of did shock everyone when Trump announced that they would all be lifted.
It shocked me.
Yeah, but it also shocked like supporters. Jim Risch, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said yesterday or 2 days ago, sometime this week. He said like, oh, we asked him to lift the sanctions, but he moved much faster than we expected. You could tell he was pissed off about this. Yeah. And I think now how to implement Trump's order is going to become a big point of contestation, because during that hearing, the appointee for Middle East, Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East, Joel Rayburn, said, and also Marco Rubio said that, like, oh, we have certain expectations of Syria. And the expectations are also very heavy lifts, like very heavy asks, which is basically join the Abraham Accords and ally with Israel, deport Palestinian terrorists, which I assume just means any Palestinian in Syria that the U.S. government doesn't like.
Yeah, who's left? Because Hamas has been gone from Syria for a long time.
I think Hamas, didn't they reopen?
Did they reopen the app? Well, it was interesting because for context for people, Hamas supported the Syrian revolution and thus was booted by the Assad regime. But you're saying that they came back.
I think they came back recently. There was also other... there are also other smaller Palestinian groups, some of which were aligned with the Assad regime. I mean, there are Palestinian groups in Syria. And also, I mean, it depends on why their definition of Palestinian terrorists. There are also there's a large Palestinian diaspora in Syria, some of them are politically active. Sharia actually recently arrested one of his commanders who's from Gaza. And it's not clear why, but so, I mean, it could be, I don't know. The U.S., the point being is that These are expectations from the American side. They're talking about full cooperation in the fight against terrorism and expelling foreign terrorists. So that could mean like the U.S. has an expectation of being able to militarily operate in Syria, which I think is also a big ask on Syrian sovereignty. And the foreign terrorists, I mean, that could be referring to a lot of the foreign fighters. To be frank, the U.S. is rightfully afraid of, but also are part of the Syrian military now. So it's again, it's unclear when he says expectations. Does this mean this is the condition, or does this mean like the sanctions are going to be lifted out of goodwill and they're sort of asking Syria to do this in return? Like it's going to be the sequencing of sanctions relief and how it's done, I think, is going to become a very contested thing in Washington.
Yeah, so the devil will be in the details. But, you know, if it does go sort of ideally, you know, then I guess this really does open up the country to the actual potential of reconstruction, because it's been, I mean, there was even, it's interesting the ways in which the sanctions affected things.
The Emirates signed some like several $100 million deal to rebuild the ports yesterday, which is like, and I mean, that's I should add, that is also one of the big driving forces behind sanctions relief. And I think a general explanation for what Trump, why Trump does what he does, is Gulf money. Like the Gulf states see a lot of money in, they before Assad fell, even they wanted to start investing. The Emirates was like itching to invest. Saudi Arabia, sort of via Jordan, was starting to make feelers. And then, of course, the U.S. sort of held like a valve on that. And now that Assad is gone, I think that they see a huge opportunity to just say, like, all right, clean slate, lift the sanctions, let us invest.
Right. Yeah, and it is a huge investment opportunity. I mean, before the war, at least, Syria had a population in the, you know, 24, 25 million range. It's a major country, large agricultural areas, large, you know, I mean, crazy history, potential for tourism, things like that. So the possibilities are kind of endless, not even including, you know, Trump Tower in Damascus or whatever. So, you know, there are lots of ways that this could develop that are interesting. So I guess, you know, this is the most hopeful I've felt. I was starting to list a little bit on hopefulness on how Syria would get out of what was going on here. But this makes me quite hopeful.
There's a lot of internal problems in Syria still. And I think that's one of the reasons why sanctions relief is such a big deal, because had Syria is, in addition to the SDF and the central government, there are other sort of, I mean, we've heard the news about different minority groups being at odds with the central government, the Alawis on the coast, the Druze in the south. There have been, and one of the reasons why the Israel lobby pushed so hard against sanctions relief is because Israel tried to exploit some of these tensions to sort of do territorial land grab. And then, of course, you do have, like I mentioned, there are foreign fighters in the Syrian government who are very scary people and are sort of out of control. There are the sort of militias that we'd mentioned before that were sort of out of control. And to add on to that, an economic crisis would have been really bad. Like to have U.S. embargo there basically permanently or there until the Syrian government kind of fulfilled a bunch of impossible, ever-changing conditions, that would be really bad for the state. So, I mean, again, the devil's in the details. Maybe they will keep pursuing these impossible conditions. But if Trump wants to do this for few preconditions, then I think that's like, it doesn't save Syria unilaterally, but it definitely gives it a fighting chance.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe one more thing, and then we can move on and talk a little bit more about other things that Trump did on his trip. But maybe one other thing to kind of at least talk about for a second is you mentioned, obviously, so Israel has done this incursion further into the Syrian territory in the south, captured some areas that include villages with Druze residents. So you've got that on one side. And then the other side, you've got Turkey, of course, who still occupies at least some. Do they still have troops on Syrian soil?
I believe they do.
Yeah, so they still have troops on Syrian soil, and they obviously
That's another issue between the SDF and the central government, is like the role of the Turkish military, and also whether people displaced by previous Turkish invasions will be allowed to go home and get their property back.
Yeah, well, exactly. And so, but so there's that. And then also, you know, how is the government going to balance between, you know, in a certain sense, I guess the U.S., you know, is leaning toward Israel here, though obviously Israel was not super happy about the sanctions relief plan. But, you know, you've got them and Israel on one side, who's kind of in the south. You've got Turkey and the actual, you know, government on the other side. And I'm kind of curious how you think the government has been managing to balance between those.
Well, I mean, the problem is just there's not much it can do. Like, as soon as the revolution, I mean, this was a very ominous thing that happened. As soon as the revolution succeeded, the Israeli Air Force just immediately destroyed as much as they could of the Syrian army stocks. And I remember some people, even who were supportive of the Syrian revolution, were sort of soft-piling this, just like, oh, they're destroying Assad's weapons. But it's like, Assad is in Moscow now. He is an exile. He's like a refugee. He's a refugee now. Like, these are things that belong to the Syrian state, right? These are what you need. And I think we saw later on, now that Syria has no air defenses. The Israelis have been able to operate, I mean, with impunity. That doesn't mean they can do whatever they want, because like on the ground even in the small amounts of land that they've tried to grab near Damascus, they run into like local resistance and they don't really have local collaborators willing to fight alongside them. But from the air, they can do a lot of damage to the state, right? Even if they can't control things, they can just kind of throw crap at the wall and see, like, you know, hit the structure with a hammer and see what breaks.
Right.
I mean, Sheraa has, that's part of the reason why the Turkish military presence is going to be a sore point between the SDF and the central government, is because Turkey is pretty much the only outside power that can prevent, that is willing and able to prevent the Israelis from going in further. And I think there was a case where they were actually surveying a site to build a new Turkish base close to the southern border, and the Israelis just preemptively bombed the site. So there is a lot of, I mean, at the end of the day, this just kind of becomes a question of like how far Turkey is willing to go to oppose the Israeli presence and challenge the Israeli presence. And I think that's an open question. I mean, Turkey has talked the talk so far, but we'll see now that the question has actually been thrust on them, what that looks like.
Yeah. Very interesting. I guess maybe this is a good time to transition to the general Trump stuff. You had a piece about his speech. I guess it was in Riyadh, the one where he railed against.
That was the serious sanctions lifting.
That was the serious sanctions lifting speech. But on top of that, there was a lot of interesting rhetorical work, right? There was railing against neocons. There was talking about, you know, a more balanced U.S. relationship with the Middle East. Do you want to talk about what he said there and how much you kind of buy it or what you make of it?
I think it does represent a victory of a certain faction in the Trump administration.
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.